That music, of course, is the theme from the Chun-Li stage in Street Fighter II, the SNES version, of course, as per our usual style. We're joined today by Jim Hewson, who just called a relatively memorable game, 7 between the Bruins and the Leafs last night. He'll be joining us. We're going to talk about matchups. We're going to talk about the Leafs-Boston Game 7, the letdown in Beantown, and of course we'll preview the Senators-Pittsburgh series. We're joined now by Jim Hewson, CBC play-by-play guy, who I'm sure you're all familiar with. Jim's coming to us from Pittsburgh, where he's preparing to cover Game 1 of the second round series between the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Ottawa Senators. How are you doing today, Jim?
I'm doing real well, thanks. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
Well, thanks for agreeing to join us. So, you might have called a pretty memorable game last night, I think.
Yeah, I'm still trying to process what I saw.
I know.
I'm sure a lot of people are. It was pretty remarkable the way that whole thing came down. I've seen some really, really wild regular season games, but I can't think of anything that I've ever seen like what I saw in Boston last night in the playoffs, particularly when it comes to a Game 7. To see one team melt down and give up a 4-1 lead and either storm back and grab the game the way they did, it was a pretty interesting and memorable night, all right.
Yeah, I mean, it almost didn't feel real while I was watching it, and I was watching it with a room filled with Leafs fans, including my girlfriend, who was, you know, apoplectic at me, because I'd sort of said, well, time for Boston to score 2 quick goals and make this interesting. just moments before the Horton goal, I was getting death stares throughout that third period.
Well, you remember, if you're watching the telecast, just before, I think it was before the Horton goal, I can't remember exactly when it was, but we showed the Maple Leafs management box, and it was when they got the 4-1 goal, actually, when Kadri scored, and a couple of people in there were cheering and high-fiving, but Dave Nonis was stoic as can be.
Right.
And I know him pretty well, and I know exactly what he was thinking. He was looking at the clock and thinking, this isn't over by any stretch, because he knows his team better than anyone else. I don't suspect or want to suggest that he was thinking we're going to blow this, but he knew it was no time to be cheering. It was no time to be too excited. And anybody who's watched the Leafs this season knows that as much as they've made some strides forward, they were still could be porous defensively. Even in, you know, as the series wore on in Boston in the middle of it, they had a couple of periods of time where they just could not touch the puck. But I sensed that even the Bruins, though, at 4-1, looked like they were pretty much done. You know, with 3 defensemen missing, it was Chara playing so much, their D looked tired, they just looked like they were about to surrender. And as one of my friends put it, in the National Hockey League, if you're an NHL team, you should be able to drink beer on the bench with a 4-1 lead and nurse that home in third period. That's just, you know, that just doesn't happen very often. But once Horton scored, you could see a little life in their legs, and you could see a little more life in the building, which a few people had vacated. And still, even at that point, I'm thinking, you know, they might give up another one here, but I can't imagine that they're going to give up 2 more. But sure enough, it happened, and it was remarkable to watch.
Yeah, I mean, after that Lucic goal to make it 4-3, you know, it was like this next 90 seconds is going to be hectic. But Boston actually came back and scored pretty quickly. I mean, that was as decisive a 3-goal comeback as you'll see.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the Lucic goal was to make it 4-3. We're still pretty late, though, so it's 1:22 left on the clock when they come to the face-off, but I thought the timeout that they took there was just absolutely, was really important for Bob, because they had a plan, and when they put Chara in front of the net, they probably should have done it earlier. Maybe that would have helped their power play through the regular season, a power play that was abysmal, had they just put Chara down in front of the net, because Reimer couldn't see a thing. He was looking high, looking low. He couldn't see anything. And the other thing was that through all of that, every time the puck was dropped, Boston won the faceoff.
Yeah.
So, you know, you knew with 1:22 to go, if the Leafs had Tyler Bozak in the lineup, they had a better chance of winning a faceoff, even at center ice, getting possession, keeping the goaltender in and allowing Rask to get to the bench, and they might have killed some more time. But save life in the late part of the hockey game, for the most part of the hockey game, they couldn't win a faceoff. And so Boston knew if they put anything together for that last push, they were going to be able to get the draw and to get possession. Whether they got the goal or not, they couldn't be assured, but they'd get a chance at it.
Yeah, and the Bozak injury ultimately was seemed to be a big deal. Some of the injuries seemed to work in Toronto's favor a bit during that series in terms of Boston's defense all going down. I mean, it was clear that Seidenberg was not himself for most of the series, I thought. And then also their injury to Mark Fraser actually ended up propelling Jake Gardner into the top four, which might have been one of the series turning points, you know, had the Leafs held on and won it. I'm actually curious to ask you about what you thought of sort of the way that Toronto matched up against Boston and whether or not Randy Carlyle deserves a lot of credit for some of his in-season adjustments, or whether or not he deserves some scrutiny, because some of the players who stepped up big for Toronto, Grabowski, MacArthur, Fratton, Gardner, were sort of press box regulars through most of the season.
Well, you know what? I think he deserves credit as opposed to the opposite. I just think that he knew what he had to work with there, and he shuffled guys in and out. I think late in the season, he gave players like Matt Fratton and like Jake Gardner a little bit of ice time and made them scratches. But at the same time, that had them ready. So he played everybody. Ryan Hamilton would be included in that group. He was moving guys in and out of the lineup. He made sure that he was sitting for really long. So he had changes that he could make. And he didn't hesitate to make them once the series started. But I think probably in an overall plan, they knew at some point in that series they were going to have a look at Jake Gardner, because it's important in the development of any players, and that would include James Reimer and that, and all their young players that had never been in the playoffs before, to see them late in the season, to see them in playoff action, because I don't think you can truly evaluate your players as a general manager and coach until you've seen them in a playoff series. So I think it was probably part of the plan to move some guys in and out. And then I thought the way he structured his lines, which were, you know, about 100 different combinations that he used after game one, I thought was good. I mean, he was working for matchups. He was an underdog. He was trying to find a way to slow the Bruins down a little bit and to free up the guys that he knew he'd have to free up to score the odd goal. And I think he did a pretty good job of that. I think all in all, what happened at the end of this is going to confuse people, because really the Leafs were the underdog. They didn't have much experience. And had they lost the series and say got blown out 5-1 last night, I don't think anybody would have been truly surprised, but it's the way they lost it. So you start, what you end up doing is starting, you break down the last 10 minutes of the game instead of the whole series. And when you look at it as a whole, it's a wonderful experience and an opportunity for the Leafs management to evaluate some of their young players. And I think overall their coach did a pretty good job, not only getting them to the playoffs, but almost getting a huge upset.
So let's quickly also talk about the Lucic non-call, which you brought up and compared to Daniel Sedin's penalty that he took, you know, 21 seconds before the Marleau goal that eliminated the Canucks with a hit sort of along the sideboards on Tommy Wingles that was pretty controversial. So I'm curious to hear sort of, Lucic obviously scores the goal to make it a one-goal game just a few seconds later. I just am curious to hear you elaborate on sort of how you saw that play.
Well, I just thought, I'm trying to even remember who he hit. There's so many things that happened in the game last night. But yeah. I thought it was a pretty dangerous play. And he's such a big man that he obliterated the guy into the boards. Where, you know, I mean, Daniel, not only was that his first boarding penalty? Somebody suggested that might have been his first hit. But, you know, he's just not that kind of guy. And Lucic is. And I just thought it was a dangerous play 3 or 4 feet from the boards. And in my opinion, it was more from behind than it was to the side. But the referees in the last 3 games of the series between Boston and Toronto were all pretty veteran crews. And they established that they were going to have a let them play mentality. And I'm not sure whether that's going to be the way it is for the rest of the playoffs for everybody. But it certainly was last night, and it was in the last 2 games. And in the previous games of the series, they really hadn't, while they let them play, the players hadn't taken advantage of that. I thought last night, in a winner-take-all game, once the players knew that the referees were going to let them go at it, they really took a lot of liberties. And so that was just one of them. And there were some things that happened in that game that, you know, all season long would have been penalties. but weren't last night. And I really don't have a problem with that, personally. You just, it's just odd when it stands out like that, that every once in a while there's a game where the rules are completely different. And having watched and listened to a lot of the controversy in Vancouver over the Daniel Sedin hit on Wingles, I just couldn't hold my tongue. I had to mention it last night because it occurred to me immediately when I saw it.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And I think, you know, there's been series that have played out in terms of the, say, Los Angeles-St. Louis series, which was, you know, extremely fun to watch for people who love defensive hockey, but certainly seemed more like a Royal Rumble than it did like a, you know, finesse hockey series. Yeah. And so this sort of leads into another question, which is, you know, in the second period especially, with the Bruins sort of beginning to get desperate, you know, the bare knuckles really sort of came out. You know, there was that sequence where Kelly elbowed JVR in the face. My favorite sequence was Leupold takes that shot, you know, at the net. Rask freezes the puck and he gets surrounded by three Bruins, all of whom take some cross checks at him. So, you know, I sort of think that the Bruins are kind of experts at filling the game with so much borderline stuff that the refs are challenged to either, you know, disrupt the flow of a showcase game, or they sort of just have to let everything go. They, you know, you can't call anything or you have to call everything sort of thing. I'm just curious to know sort of how would you game plan against that if you were, like, how would you like to see a team game plan against that, against the Bruins' ability to play off the let them play bias?
That's an interesting one. I think in the regular season, it's different from playoffs, because in the regular season, you have to be able to take action against that, you know, and the Leafs probably would have. Cole Moore would have looked after somebody. And you want to go back to 2011 when they first really did that to Vancouver, and they turned the whole playoff series against Vancouver in the middle of the series when they dragged it into the end line. That, to me, changed the whole series, and they got away with it. And even in a playoff game like that, every once in a while, you have to take action, take arms against the sea of troubles. And when that happens, you know, you don't see much fighting in the playoffs. But I thought in 2011, had somebody taken Brad Marchand out behind the woodshed and looked after him, it might have stopped the nonsense. And I'm not sure that you ever do that in a game seven, but it hadn't happened through the series, so they probably were a little bit surprised by it. Or I'm not sure if surprised is the right word, but, for example, Brad Marchand until Game 7 really hadn't been his pesky self. He really hadn't done very much. And so at that point, you're thinking, just let a sleeping dog lie. Mm-hmm. Lucic had been on and off. He'd thrown a few big hits, but he hadn't really been too nasty. That line had been scoring, so... So I don't think the Bruins had been themselves until Game 7 when they got ahead of steam going and were pretty desperate. And then you can't react and take penalties in Game 7 against them and retaliate, or you're in trouble. You just got to hope that the referees are going to call it a fair way. And I thought when the sequence you're talking about, when Leupold went over to Rask, and it was really scary, just about kicked him in the head when he lost his mask. But There could have been easily, because not only was Leupold pushed in, but mm-hmm. Rask gave him a blocker in the face, and he cross-checked a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But they'd already decided at that point that they're not going to call anything. And the difficulty there is that once you start that way, in halfway through the game, you start calling everything. Now you've got real problems, because you got everybody screaming at you, and you've got, complete disorder, and nobody knows what you're going to do. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying that the Bruins really weren't themselves until that game last night, so there wasn't really a need to react to them because they hadn't played like bullies.
No, they hadn't. I agree. So let's set up some Pittsburgh-Ottawa. What's your general take on this series? How do you see Pittsburgh as a clear favorite here?
I see them as the favorite. I don't think we can say that it's a clear favorite because they're a pretty disorganized blue line back. Their defense hasn't played real well, and their goaltending situation is a little uncertain. Thomas Vokoun is excellent in games 5 and 6 against the Islanders, mm-hmm. and he can be a really good goaltender, but I suspect they want to get back to Marc-Andre Fleury at some time, And I'm not sure that probably won't happen until Wu Kun loses a game. And I don't think he'll go undefeated through this series. So, you know, there's an iffy situation on their blue line and goaltending. And you, I mean, you saw it in the first series and the Senators. So the Pittsburgh gives up 17 goals in the first round and Ottawa gave up 9. And that's the way Ottawa is going to win this series if they win it, and that's the way they're going to keep it close. They have this habit all season long on this magical mystery tour they've been on, otherworldly this season, the way that, you know, people, such important people got out of their lineup and they still continue to play so well. And they do it because they can hang around in any game. Their defense is better than Pittsburgh's, their goaltending is better than Pittsburgh's, and that's going to allow them to hang into any game. If they start trying to trade chances with Pittsburgh, they're done. But if they can win the defensive battle and win the special teams battle, I think they can hang in there and give Pittsburgh a real scare.
I agree with basically everything you've said. I think the key for Ottawa is going to be the penalty kill, which they were the best at in the league. But so long as they don't get burned too badly by that Pittsburgh power play, I definitely think they have a fighting chance. You said something I just want to follow up on, though. You think that Pittsburgh wants to get back to Marc-Andre Fleury. Why exactly?
Well, you know what? I think if you look at the big picture, Thomas Fokun's a backup, and he's 36 years old, and you got to be thinking that at some point in this playoff, if you're going to go a long ways, he's going to need a rest, mm-hmm. going to be able to hold up, probably going to have your other guy, and you might have to build up his confidence. And, you know, what would it be like? I guess if you rode Vokun and you got to the Stanley Cup final, you just keep riding him. But I have this feeling that at some point, maybe in this series, after a couple of games, and it actually favors Vokun in the early part of it, because the series doesn't really get going, because they play tonight and they don't play again till Friday, and then when they play Sunday, they break again till Wednesday. So for an older guy with some rest, I mean, if he's winning, you could hang with him. But I suspect that they feel that Marc-Andre Fleury needs to correct some of his problems and purge some of his demons. And not only big picture being this playoff year, but big picture being long term, they're going to need him.
There's a growing body of evidence that suggests that Marc-Andre Fleury is just a sub-average NHL starter at this point. And you know, I think the Vokun signing might suggest to some that patience with Marc-Andre Fleury is waning. You don't get that sense, though.
Well, I still think that, absolutely, you're absolutely right about that, I think, because patience is waning. It has waned because they made the switch and they played Vokun the last two games. And Fleury's numbers in the last two playoffs, you know, save percentage of .891 and .834 the last 2 years in the playoffs would suggest that he's got some inner demons, he's having a real problem. And if you just watch some of the goals that he gave up against the Islanders and what his positioning was like, it was awful. Mm-hmm. But he's been their guy, and I think that I just don't see Thomas Vokun as an alternative for a long period of time.
Yeah, well, this series might have a Vancouver type feel with Pittsburgh's goaltending situation getting the bulk of the attention, despite the game being decided elsewhere. So let's pivot to the Canucks. Obviously, they were ousted in the first round, and there's a lot of hand-wringing in the Vancouver market about what they should do going forward. What's your take on this? Where do the Canucks go from here?
Well, I do believe that they've got a few decisions to make, first of all. And I don't think you toss everybody out of there. And I also think it's very difficult to make some of the moves because of the long-term contracts with no trades. So, you know, as much as people want to make a whole bunch of deals, there's a limited number that can be made, realistically, when you look at the contract situations. But there are some areas that they need to deal with. And the goaltending thing is like first and foremost. Mm-hmm. So they've botched that up badly, in my estimation, over the last few years. Once they decided to sign Roberto Luongo long-term and make him captain and all that, as we go back in history here, I think that they should have stuck with him and not changed their mind, because I thought that this playoff year, they should have been playing in the playoffs with two people in their lineup that they got for Corey Schneider.
Yeah.
Or at least one really good piece. And now it turns out, it looks like it may turn out, that they get nobody for either of them, because the market is still going to be really tough in the summertime with the cap coming down and Roberto's contract the way it is to move him out of there. But they're still going to have to find a way to deal with that, because I do think that for Corey Schneider, the whole goaltending situation was an anvil hanging over his head all season long. Whether, you know, however you want to think about what nice guys they were and how they dealt with it, and then they were real pros. But I do think that was a problem. They had a couple of decisions to make up front. What's the future for David Booth? And, you know, is he ever going to be a player? Are we ever going to see him in the lineup? And is Zach Cassian going to be a player? Mm-hmm. Is he ready to move forward and be a top six player? Because he offers them, Booth to a certain extent, and Zach Cassian to a large extent, offer them the qualities that they need in their lineup. Speed, guys who can hit, and in Cassian's case, a bigger, tougher guy to battle some of the other teams that have really gone to toughness in the Western Conference. And so, you know, once you make those two decisions, and if they're affirmative, you don't need as much elsewhere. But they do have to get, I think, a little bigger and stronger, because as you saw last night with the Boston Bruins and the Los Angeles Kings and the St. Louis Blues, the league is changing, and it looks like the league is tolerating the change, so you better go with the flow. You can see it coming for the last couple of years, and they just really haven't changed very much. But having said that, I think that the Sedins, who were below what I've ever seen them this year, will train real hard because they're like that, and they'll be determined to be better players and to be really good again next season. And there are enough pieces up front and on the defense and probably in goal that it's some refitting, but it's not rebuilding.
Yeah, and the you know, you mentioned the Sedins this season, and you know, to the eye test, it looked like they lost, you know, four steps. But when you look at the underlying data, right, and you see the way that they were used, I mean, the Canucks were a one-line team. The Sedins had less help than they've had probably during their entire careers, right, and really sort of carried a one-line team to the playoffs. I'm just curious to know, in your estimation, because I think this is the hardest question facing the Canucks this summer, can you still win a championship if the Sedin twins are your top line?
Yes, I think you can. If the second line is like 1A, you know, the way it used to be. If Ryan Kessler gets back to the level that he played at in, say, game two of the playoff series against San Jose, which is something we saw on a regular basis, and, you know, and that maybe Zach Cassian is part of that equation too. If he becomes a player and, you know, if they decide to keep David Booth and he's ever healthy, you know, if they can make that really good second line, then the Sedins, I think, can come what they were before. One of the problems I saw all season long was I can't remember Henrik Sedin and his line starting faceoffs, having to start in their own end as often as they did this past season, because that was always Kessler's job. That was always Malhotra's job, to take the faceoffs in the defensive zone. And the Sedins would always start, unless they changed on the fly, they always started in the attacking zone. And even when they started in the defensive zone this year, even if they won the faceoff, it takes a while before you can get up the ice, into the attacking zone, set up that cycle game and the way they like to play, and then get the puck to the net. The shift is over. Too often, they just got into the attacking zone and they had to change. And that's part of the reason they didn't get as many points. I just thought that because they became a one-line team, because of Kessler's injury and because Manny Malhotra's injury and not having a second or a third center for a long period of time, if you really looked at the overall picture where the Sedins started to play most of the time, it just wasn't conducive to them being the players that they had been before. So they need a supporting cast, and if they have it, they're better players. Don't think that they were very good coming out of a lockout either. I just don't think that they were quick players anyway, but they weren't as quick as they've been in the past. But I don't think that's a problem with them because they're not really old guys and they're so dedicated that they'll be better.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that analysis. The other thing was Ryan Kessler was always, you know, facing Jonathan Toews, right? If the Canucks played the Blackhawks, they were facing, Kessler was matched up against Toews. The Sedins were against a specialized defensive unit featuring Dave Boland, right? This year it was the Twins on the likes of Toews and Kopitar. And, you know, I think they did pretty admirably considering the change of the change in circumstances, but obviously it wasn't good enough.
It's a team game, you know, you can't just, you have to have a deeper team to be a really good team. And just, you know, look at the teams that are still surviving, and they're all teams that have two good offensive lines, and it's imperative to have a good third line. that can play against anybody, that you're not afraid to put on the ice, that you can use as a checking line if you need to, and you got to have a fourth line that's got a couple of guys who can get some extra ice time killing penalties. That's just the way the league works.
For sure. So this sort of naturally leads us to a segue. You know, in the early work, usually on Oilers message boards, where people were sussing out, you know, what we now know as quality of competition metrics. You know, it was sort of your attention to matchups in game during your play calls that sort of led people to decide that this might be an important factor in sort of player performance and player evaluation. So I'm curious to know, you know, how it came about that you started paying attention to those types of intricacies in your play-by-play call.
Just because my love for the game led me to want to understand the game. I was often, in my career, I've often been asked, you know, questions from aspiring young broadcasters, you know, how do I do what you do? And my answer over the last few years, and has been for quite a while actually, is understand the game. Because it's easy to call out the numbers. It's easy to see, you know, who's on the ice. It's not so easy to watch the game and have it slow down a bit for you so that you can see who's playing against whom and what the strategy of the game is. So I coached myself at the minor hockey level, which is actually, curiously, I say that in all seriousness, that it really helped me because it just, you know, it was attention to detail and learning more about the game. And plus that, I've spent so much time watching the game and talking to coaches and people that are around the game that I learn it better. So I don't just do the games on Saturday night, and that was just when I was doing the Canuck games. I watch hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hockey games over the years, and I've always tried to just understand the game a little better. And it just became obvious to me that the match game is so important in this league at that level that, you know, even because not everybody's equal. And in order to be better at the game, in order to win games, you have to exploit matchups. You have to exploit weak defensive pairs. You have to be able to get your top players out in the attacking zone. You have to get your top players out against mismatches so they can score, because otherwise you end up with a dead heat. And defensively, you know that, you know, all your defensemen aren't created equal, all your lines aren't created equal, and there's guys that you don't want on the ice in certain situations. And it's a rare team that is deep enough not to be concerned at all about the matchups. So that's sort of the history of it. And I still watch it, and some nights, you know, I watch it, and it's really obvious, and it's really obvious that it's having an effect on the game. And other nights, maybe power plays or penalty killing or things like that happen, or it just, the game takes off and there's never stoppages in play, and so the matchups just aren't obvious, or they aren't happening, or the coaches decide, ah, hell with it, let's just go. Mm-hmm. And so it's very different every night, but usually there's some obvious ones, and I'm always looking for it because that's part of the strategy of the game.
Yeah, and we got an interesting sort of look at that in that Boston-Toronto series, which occasionally resembled a chess match. Do you pay attention at all? Have you paid attention at all to how sort of these matchup metrics have been, you know, quantified and stuff online over the past couple of years?
I have, actually. I'm interested in it. I don't fully understand some of the things people are doing, but I have... I've examined behind the net and that sort of thing, and mm-hmm. I've looked at some of the advanced statistics that people are putting forward, I do believe they have some credibility. I do believe that, but I think you have to package them with everything else.
Yeah.
You can't just quantify everything through a statistical look at it. I still believe you have to look at the overall thing. There's so many variables in hockey that change things. You know, let's just, you know, suggest that 4 games and 6 nights, or 2 games and 3 nights, and tired teams, road teams, distance of travel. There are times in the season where even the best teams look awful.
Yeah.
And you just throw everything out the window. There are times in the season where the best players in the game have lousy nights, and there's various reasons why they do that. Or there's players that come out of nowhere and have a wonderful night, and they could be playing against the top line on the other team. And statistically, you might look at that and think, well, he must be a great player. But then you don't see him again for 6 weeks. So, you know, I just think you can lump all of that stuff in together, but you can never look at any one particular thing in and of itself to explain the whole story.
I think the biggest leap that these advanced stats have sort of helped us make is targeting what to look at on video. And I think that marriage is sort of starting to bear a lot of fruit in the hockey blogosphere over the last little bit. So finally, one more question. Which of these sort of numbers out there on Behind the Net, what do you think's next in terms of becoming mainstream or helping someone such as yourself or, Chris Cuthbert or Kelly Rudy or whomever tell the story of a game? Like, which stat do you think is going to come out and be the most helpful for mainstream broadcasters over the next year or two?
That's an interesting one. I'm kind of interested in things like I have a problem with shots because I like the sort of thing that, how many shots do you get when this guy is on the ice and how many shots are against, for example, D'Antoine, how many shots against when he's on the ice. But I can't just take shots. I need scoring chances. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure because that's such a subjective thing. I'm not sure how you quantify that and how you put that into a statistic.
And that's all the time we have on this sixth episode of the Canucks Army Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.